KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
There was very much a sense, I think, among a good portion of the nobility that this was retribution. This was payback for centuries of serfdom.
This is Walter Cronkite, saying good night. Good night.
I made the cranberry gingerbread muffins they have a recipe for, and they were a big hit in my family.
That was Sarah Dickerman talking about holiday food. Sarah Dickerman's going to be in for an extended visit today talking about cookbooks you might want to give to people who love to eat and to cook. We had a little blooper, Walter. How did he say his name? Walter Cronkite from The Unpredictable World of Live Radio and Douglas Smith on the downfall of Tsarist Russia's elite. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. These days, when you think about Russia, if you do think about Russia, you probably think of a nation trying to define itself after decades of Soviet communism. In the scope of Russia's long history, the Soviet Union was relatively short-lived, but many Russians don't know a lot about the people who ruled their country before 1917. Historian Douglas Smith explores the fall of the Russian aristocracy in his new book. It's called Former People, The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy. Douglas Smith is an award-winning historian. He worked for the U.S. State Department in the Soviet Union. He writes books about Russia, and he's in the studio. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
When I hear that word aristocracy, I think of the Tsar. I think of the Romanovs, but it's a wider definition in your book. So maybe we should start with like talking about what we are talking about.
Exactly. When we're talking about the Romanovs, obviously we're just talking about the Romanov family, who were essentially obviously the rulers of Russia. Beneath them was the Russian nobility, which was around 1900 was almost 2 million people. And the cream of the nobility is the aristocracy, which was about 100 families, the most powerful, the wealthiest, the greatest longevity in history of the nobility. So it's sort of the cream of the elite.
And we're talking about families whose land holdings, whose fortunes go back centuries?
Definitely, centuries. Some of these people have recorded histories that are 700 years, in fact, that go way, way, way back and had been in service to first the Grand Princes of Muscovy and then later the Tsars of Russia.
And so one of the things that I noted in reading this book was how many princes there were. When I hear that word prince, I think, well, that's the brother of a king. But that isn't quite who they were. So is it that they had their own fiefdoms or their own like mini kingdoms?
That's true. Yeah, it's a bit confusing, the nomenclature, and we want to sort of view it within the terms that we're familiar with. But exactly, typically in Russia, if someone was a prince, that did not mean they were a member of the royal family. Typically, those people were known as grand dukes or grand duchesses. Princes were simply members of the aristocratic elite that had been brought into Russian service at some point.
So 100 families, you chose to focus on two families, and here I will try to pronounce their name, Sheremetyevs and Golitsyns.
Pretty good, Sheremetyev and Golitsyn.
And why did you choose these two? Talk about in general.
Sure, that was one of the challenges in writing the book, because I talk about the entire noble class, this roughly 2 million people, and I knew that to convey a real personal sense of what these experiences were like, I needed to get down to the point of individual lives. So for a year or so when I started the research, I was hunting around for families who left behind a great deal of documentation, first of all, people with a lot of letters, diaries, memoirs, photographs, because without them you can't tell their stories, and then families who had stayed in Russia, the Soviet Union. I didn't want to write about those people who had left because, you know, we have images of what it was like to be some poor, dispossessed Russian prince playing violin in a Parisian cafe. But these people who don't get out, who remain trapped in the Soviet Union, that was my focus. So I cast about widely reading about all of these families, and I settled on the Sheremetyevs and Golitsyns because they left such a wealth of information that I could really, really understand the individual lives I was talking about.
You mentioned in the introduction to the book, though, that you were in an archive. I'm not sure you're working on this book. You were working on something else, and there weren't a lot of records about anybody who had been nobility, ever. And it was like they had fallen off the face of the earth. So how did you go about even finding out who these people were?
Well, that was interesting. Yeah, it was when I first was getting the idea for the book. And I was working in the largest library in Russia, which was used to be called the Lenin Library. And in those days, this is 2005, they still had most of the books were in the old card catalog. And I went to the subject theme, and they had row after row of cards on the history of the great October Socialist Revolution, every possible aspect of the revolution, from the revolution in toothpaste to the revolution and, motorized vehicles. But there was nothing on the revolution in the nobility. And I found this strange. So I went up to one of the nice librarians there at the library. I said, excuse me, I'm just an ignorant foreigner, but I can't seem to find that section on the revolution and the nobility. And she looked at me like I was crazy. Like, what are you talking about? Of course there's nothing on the revolution and the nobility because they had nothing to do with it. And it's when someone is that categorical, you know that you're onto the right subject. And so from there, I just kind of started digging in archives. And I also traced families that had survived and got to know these families. And it was through them that I came in contact with fascinating material.
Well, so here we have these two families that you decided to mainly focus on. And you said you were looking for families who had survived. You have an archivist, a head of an archive, who will tell you, well, they had nothing to do with it. I'm not going to talk about it. How did you find survivors, and how did you convince them to show you diaries and I mean, these are stories of people whose relatives were imprisoned and then killed.
Right, right. It grew out of my previous book, which was called The Pearl, which is a story of this fabulously wealthy 18th century Russian aristocrat who fell in love with one of his serfs who was an opera singer. And I got to know the descendants of that family, the Sheremetyevs, and they kind of got me interested in this story. And literally it was a kind of thing where I had to get to know one person who's a descendant of these people and convince them that I was honest, I was serious, I was a true scholar, and that I would approach this with the sensitivity and respect that it really warranted. And literally they would lead me from one person to another person to another person all over Russia, the United States, England, France. So it was really sort of a global undertaking.
We're talking with Douglas Smith. His new book is called Former People, The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy. And we were talking about the two families, the Sheremetyevs and Golitsyns. I'm going to maybe get that name by the end of it. I think that we all, if we think at all about Russian aristocracy, you kind of think, serfs versus aristocracy. But these two families had really different points of view in general about the czar, about continuing on this sort of kingdom, this czardom, and modernity, right?
Exactly, exactly. And that was another reason I loved finding these two families to write about, because the Sheremetyevs represented what you might call the Slavophile tradition, this idea that Russia is unique, it's not the West, it has its own distinct history, institutions, supporters of autocracy. The Golitsyns were true liberal Westernizers. Although very elite, wealthy, powerful, connected, were extremely critical of the Tsar state. They wanted reforms, they wanted freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. They wanted an elective government. And this was back in the 1890s. And so one of the things that I hope my book does is muddy the waters. It's easy to think, oh, these people must have all been reactionary right-wingers, when in fact it was politically very complicated.
The other thing that you spend quite a bit of time on is talking about the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas, who was the last one there. And you portray a kind of weak leader, somebody who's very indecisive, and somebody maybe whose presence as czar might have helped speed up the events that led up to the revolution. Is that a fair description?
That's an excellent description. He was sometimes referred to or compared to a pillow.
That's a horrible way to describe somebody who's leading a nation.
In the sense, yeah, that's not good. That's not a good sign. In the sense that he reflected the ideas of the last person who he spoke to. In other words, sort of as a pillow leaves the impression of the last rear end that was on it. That was kind of how people thought of Nicholas II. He was weak, ineffectual, and at a critical moment in Russia's history where they needed the most talented of people on the throne. They had somebody who really wished he was an English squire, and it was all just too much for him. And it's one of the tragedies of Russian history that at that utterly critical point in its history, it didn't have a Peter the Great or someone, or a Catherine the Great, someone like that on the throne.
So here you have this weak leader. Anybody who, like the Golitsyns, those kinds of families that advocated liberalism were on the outs with the czar. So there's all this kind of roiled mess with the aristocracy itself. And then you have this movement. There had been, you sort of chronicle the various peasant uprisings that have been, that come to fruition, they're put down, but it's sort of this escalation of more than discontent, I was going to say discontent, anger, fury, that boils up. But a lot of the leadership of that revolution was not just peasants, but they were members of this aristocracy themselves.
Well, it's interesting to note, and some people forget, that the greatest revolutionary of the 20th century, if you will, was a Russian nobleman. That meeting, Lenin himself, was born into a noble family. Some of the material wealth of being born into a noble family allowed him to spend long hours studying Marx, so he could then go out and lead revolution. So it is important, I think, to recognize, again, the political diversity within the nobility. There were extreme left-wing radicals among the nobility, Prince Kropotkin, the great anarchist, or Bakunin, the great anarchist, all members of the nobility.
So we, you know, I'm just picturing chaos, anarchy. we've got uprisings. We've got people on a lot of agitating on a lot of levels, not necessarily for revolution, but for change. A lot of those people from the elite classes themselves, and it happens. And there are people many people who left Russia as they knew this was going to erupt, as you mentioned, in Paris full of the so-called white Russians playing violins. But a lot of people either didn't want to deal with it. They had family issues that occupied them. They're at home. They don't want to leave their home. And these folks are within a span of, you know, not much more than a decade, are rounded up and destroyed.
Yes, it's a really... It was a very difficult book to write. You know, I feel like I got to know these characters reading their personal documents and things. And then you see what happens to them in the 20s, the teens, the 20s, the 30s. And the repression just goes on and on in these successive waves. And it's really, it's a very horrifying thing to deal with. I started out wondering why anyone stayed in Russia. Mm. But of course, we only ask that question because we know what's going to happen. No one knew what was going to happen, and no one thought the Bolsheviks would stay in power, that it would just, they would have a moment and then they would have a more moderate form of government and everything would go back to normal.
Well, I couldn't help think about Nazi Germany, which annihilation of groups of people, not noble people, but a lot of people with a lot of money. It was like class extermination. Was it the times? Was there something specific that made people think if we just kill everybody, this germ will be destroyed? I mean, why?
Well, that's, you know, if I had an answer to that question, I'd my name would be very well known in the world. What it was about the 20th century, whether it was you know, Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia, you know, some people trace it back to the Enlightenment. Some people trace it back to attempts to move into modernity. There are all these different theories about what it was that created the 20th century that was so horribly, horribly bloody. I don't know. In the Russian case, clearly, I think much of what happens with 1917, the revolution, is an explosion that had been building and building for centuries. Serfdom was bloody and it was cruel. And even though it ended in the 1860s, it was, the legacy continued on. And what you had after several years of the First World War of just mindless bloodletting, most of those people were all peasant soldiers. There was literally just this explosion of violence and a sense of, we are going to do away with the old order that has kept us down for hundreds of years.
Physically do away with the old order,
yes.
Not just overturn the old order.
No, annihilate them and rip them out by their roots and burn them.
So in 2005, Soviet Union, I believe, was done at that point in time. And is there a move for people to re-acknowledge this history of their country? I mean, this country did not start in 1917, as you mentioned, 700 years before that of culture and tradition.
Right, right. This, I think in the early 90s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was this great fascination with the Tsarist past. And there were people who really wanted to know their roots and know what life was like before the Soviet system. There was a good deal of nostalgia, of sort of viewing the past in overly optimistic terms. I think now we've seen that it's kind of swung back under Putin, where there's this attempt to take some bits from the past and change them, but ultimately to sort of meld it together with some of the statism and power of the Soviet system. Interesting, my book is being translated into a number of foreign languages, but I have yet to find a Russian publisher. And I think talking to some of my Russian friends, it's this sense that as a foreigner, I don't have a right to tell the story of such horrific proportions. So it's an interesting time in terms of how Russia is now trying to create a new national identity out of these various disparate parts of its past.
In all the research that you did, because it was probably about 6 years of research before you actually got this to fruition, sort of tracking all these people down, was there any story that really stopped you in your tracks?
Oh, there were so many. There were so many stories that stopped me in my tracks. I think the one that really gets to me, and it's terrible. I've given talks about the book all over the place, and when I get to this point in my talk, I choke up. A couple times I actually broke down in tears. There's a story of a family, a Galitzin family, where the father was repeatedly arrested for no reasons other than the fact that he had been born into the wrong family, and he's finally arrested the last time in 1941, and he knows it's coming, and he's walked down the street to jail, and he's followed by his young son. I'm getting emotional even just talking about it now. And the police agents say, you know, get on home, send the boy back home. The father turns to his son and says, Mishka, go home, hugs him, and he never sees him again.
Did you meet Mishka?
I did. I met this man who's now in his 80s. And what's so amazing, a wonderful man, Mikhail Galitzin, in his 80s, he and his wife Tamara, they had me for lunch, even though they were planning a move. They had boxes everywhere in Moscow, had me for lunch. We drank a lot of vodka, talked a lot about it. And even though all these horrible things had been done to his family and he'd lost his father and other loved ones, he said to me, Douglas, as they call me in Russian.
Douglas?
The real tragedy that you need to write about is the fact that my eldest son died of cancer. That's the tragedy I want you to write about. And I was thinking all the things that had befallen this man, to see his father carted off to the gulag, never to be seen again. And he had moved on from all that, and it was the loss of his son from an illness that he couldn't let go of.
So when you travel back and forth to Russia, which you do a lot, I mean, how do you feel about this country that you've devoted so many years to?
It's complicated. It's I love Russia. I love its culture, its history, its people. I have so many wonderful friends there. At other times, it makes me want to pull my hair out. I will say I'm glad I live in the West, where I think you can say historically a little bit greater respect for law. We have our problems, of course, but it's not a place where you really feel that in some sense you're legally protected. Let's put it that way. But I love to go, and I love the language. I love so much about the place.
Douglas Smith is a Seattle-based historian, translator. He focuses, so far, on Russia. His newest book is called Former People, The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is KUOW Seattle.
During the golden age of radio, the pace of being a full-time radio actor was a frenzied one. Hollywood film actors may have scoffed at radio, but many also feared performing on it. Coming up, weekday producer Katie Sewell joins us with her latest radio retrospective. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Genius, a baby academy, a class for early learning where babies explore art and music, sensory play, motor skills practice, and more. Babies attend with caregivers and connect with new friends, located in Madison Valley, central Seattle. Gift certificates and more at geniusbabyacademy.com.
We have cloudy skies and 44 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds all day, the high in the mid-40s. Clouds and rain tonight, the low in the upper 30s. Clouds again tomorrow with a chance of rain, the high in the low 40s.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Ah, yes, Thursday. It's time. We were just in Tsarist Russia. It's time to travel back to the golden age of radio. It's time for our radio retrospective with producer Katie Sewell. And I'm glad this music, Katie, is kind of calming me down from bloodshed in Russia.
I don't know. The topic of today's radio retrospective might speed you back up again.
The frenzy of live radio?
The frenzy of working in live radio.
It is indeed.
Yes. So during the golden age of radio, radio acting was considered a step up if you were a vaudevillian performer. But if you were a movie star, that was not the case. If you were a film actor and you appeared on the radio, it was considered slumming or a sign that you're after fast money or you're having trouble getting work.
Well, that's true. If you're a movie star today and you were going to go on TV, people wonder why Dennis Quaid has a TV series.
Exactly. It does hold true. You know, a movie actor is not going to appear on the television unless it's a really prestigious show. A great example, modern day example, is when Matt Damon appeared on 30 Rock playing the pilot named Carol.
Can I tell you what I hate about you? You're so stubborn when you think you're right, even when the answer is on the Trivial Pursuit card.
The card was wrong. And you're no better, Carol. You built that bookshelf incorrectly.
I did not. I wanted the books to slide off.
Sounds a whole lot like Alec Baldwin there.
Well, during the golden age, occasionally a big star would guest star on the radio as well, but only on the really big shows like Lux Radio Theater or Jack Benny or the show Suspense. Here's an example of that.
Suspense. A full 60 minutes at this time. Tonight, our star in one of his rare radio appearances, Mr. James Cagney.
Wow, really?
One of his rare radio appearances.
I didn't know that James Cagney ever really did radio.
He did a little bit here and there, all of which I own because I loved James Cagney, but
okay, so these are,
it wasn't great.
Yeah, I was going to say these people were used to a different kind of acting, right?
Right, not used to having to act with their voices. So there were a lot of other reasons why film stars were very intimidated by the radio as well, and they generally don't come off as being very good.
Ah.
So film actors were rare on the radio, but other actors, especially actors who could do a lot of different voices, thrived on the radio. Stage actors would use the radio as a job while they were waiting to see if they'd gotten into the Broadway play that they were auditioning for.
Yeah.
During the Depression, a lot of radio actors could survive acting by working in radio. So actor Stats Cotsworth was one of those people that loved radio so much that he abandoned a successful Broadway career for the financial security of radio. He often called radio his life insurance policy. Huh. And he was one of the lucky few that got a regular recurring role. He played Casey on the show Casey Crime Photographer, which is about a newspaper photographer that solves crime, often before the police get to solve the crime.
I love those crusading journalists.
Shall we listen to a sample of what kept him in the black?
That window being locked 2 inches from the bottom, that bothers me.
Well, now, why?
Well, why should the killer take the time to do that? Nobody was likely to notice whether that window was closed or open. There was no darn reason for that window. Hey, there's always a reason for everything.
Hmm?
Excuse me, Annie. I'll see you later.
Where are you going?
I'm going to take a walk and think.
So that was it. He was the star.
He was the star, yeah. And some radio actors had recurring roles, but many of them never did. And for years, actually, a lot of them never even appeared in the credits. That took a lot longer in radio's history.
Because they didn't require it.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. So if you're not having a regular role, that did not mean that you were out of work, especially if you were talented. It just meant that you had to run from one studio to another on a tight deadline every single day.
Hence the frenzy of live radio.
Yes. And remember that at this point, all the shows, all these dramas are performed live, and they're often repeated one performance for the East Coast and one performance for the West Coast.
Wow.
So I thought it would be fun to go through an example of what it would be like to do this.
Okay.
This is the day in the life of radio actor Matt Crowley. It was an example I found in the book Raised on Radio by Gerald Nachman. He started work at 9 a.m. with a rehearsal for the radio soap opera called John's Other Wife at NBC. Very hard to find copies of John's Other Wife nowadays.
Not something I've heard of. Okay.
Matt Crowley was playing John, who in this episode is delirious with fever.
Loyalty. Give it to me. Come. Marina.
Marina.
I want you. Marina. Come to me.
That's not Marina, I take it.
And then he hired a stand-in actor to finish that rehearsal, grabbed a cab to CBS to be the announcer on the show Pretty Kitty Kelly.
The bakers of Slow-Baked Wonder Bread and Hostess Cupcakes present Pretty Kitty Kelly.
Now, back to NBC for the East Coast broadcast of John's Other Wife.
Marina!
Marina!
I want you. Marina, I need you.
John, I'm here. Your wife, Elizabeth.
Marina!
No!
Marina, come!
No!
Marina!
Who's Marina? That's what I want to know. Okay.
This is delirious with fever. Then go back to CBS to make the last announcement for the show Pretty Kitty Kelly.
Are you sure that the bread you pay out your good money for is the best bread you can buy? Actually, 525,000 women compared all good breads for texture, fragrance, and flavor. And an average of 89 out of every 100 women have judged slow-baked Wonder Bread to be the best bread of all. So if you haven't tried Wonder Bread, the slow-baked bread, why not pick up a loaf at your food store today? Better fragrance and better flavor.
Wonder Bread.
Yes. Now, hold the elevator and get that cab back for the West Coast performance of John's Other Wife, which started at 10:15.
Marina, come to me. I need you.
John, I'm here. Your wife, Elizabeth.
Marina.
No.
Marina, come.
No.
Marina.
You can't have her, do you hear?
I still want to know who Marina is. Wow, that's a day.
Oh, that's a soap opera for you, right? I mean, they're still doing those plot lines today. Yep. Quite a day.
Yeah.
And as you know, live radio waits for no one, so no. You better hold those cabs. Really, really busy actors at the time would even, some of them would hire an ambulance to go from one studio to another.
So they could get a siren.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which wasn't illegal at the time, believe it or not.
Wow.
So you could race through the stoplights. So actors could make a lot of money if they could do multiple voices and accents and get cast in more than one show a day.
I'm having a hard time making this work in my mind, but yeah, okay. There's people who did that.
There are people who did it. Orson Welles is one of the famous ones. He did it really well. In fact, he was so good at it that eventually he was earning $1,500 a week at a rate of $18.50 per show.
That's a lot of money in those days.
A lot of money in those days, but that would also mean 81 different performances a week.
Okay.
So as a treat, I've put together a little montage of various shows he appeared in to let you see his voicing skills.
Danny, I want you for the leading man in my next picture. It's going to be a sequel to Spellbound.
Sequel to Spellbound? Well, what's it called?
Son of Spellbound.
One cloudy night, 10 years ago, I was walking along the quay by the river.
Dr. Manette.
That is my name.
Dr. Manette, formerly of Beauvais.
I am that Dr. Manette.
Do you know any big words?
Big words? Have you ever heard the word tessellated?
Yes. Tessellated means to be adorned with mosaic.
Who asked you what it meant?
I felt in this moment the agonies of 100 deaths. For as my eyes grew dark, I saw with horror the thing he had in his mind. I cried out with all my might. Anna! Anna! And darkness seized me.
Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Oh, my dove, that art in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs. Let me see thy countenance. Let me hear thy voice, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely.
I'm eating chicken every day.
Good.
I have my own recipe, chicken a la Claghorn. First, I soak my chicken overnight in Kentucky butter. Then I boil it in Louisiana corn.
Yes.
Then I baste it with Mississippi mint julep.
Yes.
Then I leave it in the skillet over a slow fire for 2 days.
And the chicken's ready?
I don't bother with the chicken.
No?
When I get through lapping up that gravy,
yes,
I'm southern fried. So...
Wow, that is quite a range.
Quite a range. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, he was great.
He used to refer to his ability to do that as skipping nimbly.
Yeah,
the
well,
roles.
Did
he,
it well.
He, like many actors, also had people hold elevators for him, and he hopped cabs to get to jobs on time. And he has a record for skipping rehearsal completely a lot of the time. He recalled what this was like in a quote I read by him. He said, I'd come to a bad end in some tearjerker on the 7th floor of CBS. Then I'd rush up to the 9th floor, where just as the red light was going on, somebody would hand me a script and whisper, Chinese Mandarin, 75 years old, and I'd be off again.
Wow.
So just a little bit of a cue.
Well, you know, it's just, I was thinking, I don't know that there's anybody who has that facility on radio these days,
mm-mm,
even the best radio actors.
I mean, people just aren't in practice for this, really, on the whole anymore. The industry has pretty much faded away. But at the time, you could get trained to do things like this as well. So that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
Well, circling back, remember we started with the film actors,
yeah,
who thought of radio as slumming. Many of them also found it incredibly scary.
Because it was live?
Because it was live.
Yep.
No retakes. There's nothing that you can do but carry on. And film actors just don't have to do that. And as for the listening radio audience of the Golden Age, that was a really golden time, because the fact that all of the dramas on the air were happening in real time, it added to the thrill of listening to a show.
I would bet, yeah.
Yeah, it was like a play was being performed for you personally in your own living room. It was almost like going to the theater but not having to leave anywhere.
Yeah, in your pajamas.
Yeah, if only that was still going on. There, and of course, you know, it added to the thrill to hear things go wrong from time to time because it was live radio. So shall we listen to a few bloopers just to end?
Yeah, it'll make me feel better. Let's go.
Okay. Go for Pepto-Bismol and Sunday News Special. This is Walter Cronkite saying good night. Good night.
Castles may tumble, that's fate after all. Life's really funny that way. Sang the wrong melody, we'll play it back. See what it sounds like, hey, hey. He cut out 8 bars, and I didn't know which 8 bars he was gonna cut. Why don't somebody tell me these things around here?
Feel that power float on that smooth action, and then be surprised that a car like this can be yours for the amazingly low, unbelievable price of $7,200. Well, that should be $2,700.
That sounded low to me, Katie.
Yeah, I know. But back then, everyone was like, gasp.
Well, I was just thinking about Bing Crosby's ability to sort of croon through a song and not know the words that he was going to sing, but he just kept going.
Yeah.
That was great.
And he still sounds beautiful while he's just filling time.
I mean, I actually had to stop a second and think, wait, oh, that isn't the words that they really wanted him to sing, is it?
Yes. He's saying, I've lost the thread of where I'm supposed to be.
So, well,
still, even though radio is still one of the only places where you will hear things live, like right now,
uh-huh,
as the years go by, as we know in the industry, that's also starting to fade away. It's starting to be much more common for things to be recorded ahead of time.
And is this where we tell people to call 543-9595? Oh, no, that's some other month, right?
Right, right.
Well,
keep that in mind for the next pledge drive.
Yeah, it's lonely live when you make it. So, Katie Sewell, as always, such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take a little trip back to the golden days of radio on KUOW Seattle.
Good morning, it's 10:39. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. We have cloudy skies and 44 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting clouds all day, the high in the mid-40s. Clouds and rain tonight, the low in the upper 30s. Clouds again tomorrow. Rain in the morning, chance of rain in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle area Whole Foods Markets, presenting Bag Hunger, a charitable event taking place throughout this holiday season with proceeds directed toward local nonprofit Solid Ground, November 28th until December 31st. More information at wholefoodsmarket.com.
Energy expert Amory Lovins.
What if we could make energy do our work without working our undoing? Could we have fuel without fear? Could we reinvent fire?
Amory Lovins on the path to completely ending our dependence on oil and coal by 2050. That's the next conversation. I'm Ross Reynolds, and I hope you can join us.
And that comes your way at 12:20 this afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from Chinook Book, featuring goods and services from more than 500 local merchants in Seattle and the Puget Sound area, dedicated to building an economy that supports small businesses helping community organizations. More at chinookbook.net.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. If you are like me, you probably have not yet finished your holiday shopping, or maybe you have not even started your holiday shopping. You have less than 2 weeks, just to let you know. Maybe you're planning to just go to a local bookstore, or go online and find a book for everyone on that list. Even, I have to say, as a cook, with the explosion of food apps and other gizmos that you can do on an iPad or some other tablet, most home cooks like physical cookbooks. There's just something about opening up the pages and looking at the recipes and leafing through. And joining me with some ideas for chefs or eaters on your list is Sarah Dickerman. Writes about food, cooks food, eats food, and it's so nice to have you here in person.
I love being here, and I agree. It's so interesting with cookbooks. I think I use the web a lot to find recipes and get good ideas, too. But I think you can lose yourself in a cookbook and really introduce you to a new world. And also, yet I know what's going to happen. Apps will get easier to cook with. But right now, with your phones turning off or your iPad turning off, it's actually kind of a tricky way to cook.
There are, I mean, just if you like to cook with an iPad, there are these new sleeves.
Yeah.
Because the hard part is tapping on the screen.
Yeah.
To keep it from going black.
Yeah.
And like if you're baking and you're tapping on the screen, that sounds
really gritty.
Yeah, it's really kind of crummy. I have to say, these days there are cookbooks for every conceivable type of chef and eater, but also readers. There's sort of the memoir cookbook, you know, that's what I call them. There's gluten-free cooks, there's ethnic cookbooks, there's sort of general cookbooks for people who want an everyday book.
Right, right. And I love all those categories. What you were mentioning, ones for readers, one of the more readerly ones that I recommended is a book on Burma.
Yeah, I see it down
under Naomi Duguid. And she had been partnered with Jeffrey Alford, and they had done these wonderful cookbooks, one on China, one on Southeast Asia, very photography heavy, gorgeous, incredibly interesting ethnographic information. So now she's on her own, and she did this book on Burma, just as Burma's opening up and really becoming a place that people are going to interact with a lot more. And it's a really special book. Great location photography with lots of images of, you know, food sellers on the street.
So even you might even think if somebody's sort of an armchair traveler,
yeah, exactly,
they might like this book just as a sort of cultural document.
Yeah, even if you weren't to cook from it, I think you could take away so much from this book, as with all their books.
It does make you want to eat, though.
And yeah, and it does make you want to eat. And there's great noodle dishes. There's really, you know, some flavors that are familiar, but just a little tweaked. Lots of fried shallots, bit of shrimp paste for, you know, they use shrimp paste. Like, you know, in Vietnamese cooking, you'd use fish sauce a little bit. Lots of noodle dishes and grilled stuff. And it's a really fun, exciting cookbook. And I think you'll learn a lot about the culture spending time with it, too.
Now, have you cooked out of each of these books that you've brought in?
I have cooked out of lots of them. And I have some of them are so new that I haven't had a chance to really cook a lot with them.
Well, this one is called Burma, really for the armchair traveler among us. But maybe you are just somebody who wants to, you live on Capitol Hill in Seattle, and you've got a little kitchen,
yeah,
you know, a little electric oven, and you want to cook. You want to stop buying takeout.
Right.
You have brought in something that you recommend for that.
Yes, I have. Although I've loaned out my copy of the book.
It's the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook.
It's the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook, which is an unexpected huge bestseller, which is great. Is this, Deb Perlman writes the Smitten Kitchen blog. It's a wonderful, really lively blog. And she cooks mm-hmm. in a tiny kitchen herself. So like anything she does, she knows about the compromises you have to make in a home kitchen. It's not like some of these cookbooks that are developed in a big restaurant kitchen, and then you try to do them at home and it just doesn't quite work.
I got a couple of those and they're really beautiful to look at. There's two things about them. One is it doesn't quite work. And some of them I'm like, yeah, really, I'm not going to do those 10 steps. And
and
I don't have, 1800 BTUs on my stove. I have a regular stove.
Exactly. So she gets to the heart of what's cool about the compelling thing about a recipe. Say she does there's a mussel recipe in there, and she's like, I've been trying to figure out how to make oven fries, because even though I love French fries, I can't eat actually fried French fries every day. So she figured out an oven fried method where you boil the potato first and then you cook it in, and it just makes a much better fry. It's a little detail like that, not too complicated, but then elevates the food. And I really like that. She loves Middle Eastern flavors, which I love too.
Mm-hmm.
So, things like pomegranate seeds and lots of herbs and just, great pistachios and stuff like that.
Yum, yum.
So you find lots of great flavors there. A really inspiring cookbook. And she's funny too.
That's called the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. You can mm-hmm. you can find her blog, which is called the Smitten Kitchen, mm-hmm. and it is great. I'm going to go because I'm thinking of your tiny kitchen. You mentioned restaurants, and you brought in a cookbook that I hope is going to reveal every secret of Tom Douglas's Dahlia Bakery.
I know. I'm pretty excited about it because I can't get near that store and not buy the truffle. For me, it's the double chocolate truffle cookies.
I have to say that those I might attempt to make. I usually try to eat coconut pie from time to time in a Tom Douglas restaurant, but I don't know. I think that recipe is in there, but I'm never going to attempt to make it. I'll let their bakeries.
Just let it be wonderful in your mind.
But these are in here.
They're in here. Everything. I mean, because, of course, the secret of a bakery is not just the recipe, but it's the doing it just right and doing it thousands and thousands of times until it gets just right. So they're not worried about giving away their secrets, I think.
They know that coconut pastry dough you will not make well yourself. Or maybe you will.
I think you have to pick and choose. I think that's the thing. But they have so many fun things. They have the little hand pies that they make, those portable pies.
Mm-hmm.
And English muffins and did I mention cookies?
Yes, you did. Truffle cookies.
And also my other favorite, the double peanut butter cookie. Have you had those?
I have had those.
Sandwiched?
Yeah, they are wonderful. Now, these you think a baker, somebody who likes to bake, could make at home?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that first of all, bakers are a very particular personality type, and they tend to be obsessive, which is great. It's good because I'm sort of more casual. I'm a casual cook. I do.
You
like
have
to,
bake, yeah.
But
you
I'm
have,
not. That's not my prime.
Well,
thing.
No, it's chemistry. You have to measure things
exactly. So here, there's great illustrations on method and stuff like that in this cookbook. It's nicely put together. So if there's a tricky detail of folding a dough or something, it's well documented in photographs. Yeah.
I love it. Sarah Dickerman sent us this great email, and she's got, and you can get these recommendations if you go to kuw.org/weekday. But you've got your books parceled out by not category of book, but by category of reader cook/cook. So you have one called The Conscientious Carnivore.
I do.
So tell me exactly what a conscientious carnivore would be.
Well, I think you run into a lot of them in urban America today. It's someone who eats meat but doesn't want to just get factory processed meat, wants to know more about grass-fed meats, or maybe is going in on a pig with friends and mm-hmm. they have a freezer and they're all going to divide it up. But some of those things can be a little bit tricky too, because you might be faced, if you're sharing, say, a quarter of a pig with friends, you might get a cut of a meat that you've never encountered before.
Yes.
And so for that, I recommended Bruce Adell's Great Meat Cookbook, which has, again, it's really helpful as a guide because it has like photographs of different cuts of meat. It has information on what what grass fed, the texture of grass fed meat versus,
which is different.
Yeah, corn fed. Yeah, so it's really helpful as a reference, and then it just has yummy looking, brawny. I mean, he's definitely a brawny cook, and you know, things like a steak sandwich with Caesar dressing on the steak sandwich, or deviled ham. Really fun things, great rib recipes, and great photographs again.
Joyce emails, we should mention that Greg Atkinson has a book called At the Kitchen Table.
Oh, yeah, that's a lovely book.
It is a lovely book, but I don't think it's with his mother's peanut butter fudge. I've actually attempted some of Greg's cookie recipes as mm-hmm. well, because he's published them, and those are lots of fun. So this is somebody, the pig butchering, sharing half a cow friends, the folks that like to sort of do the meat and sit around and drink glasses of red wine. And
right. Might be interested in beginning to cure something or making sausage at home. You know, it's deep on the subject. It's definitely not for someone who's like trying to go almost meatless.
Okay. Do you have something for somebody who maybe wants to add more vegetables?
You know, officially I don't on the list that I gave you, but I brought two of my very favorite books from this year. I brought the Alain Passard, The Art of Cooking with Vegetables, which I think is just a lovely, lovely cookbook, illustrated in a very interesting way with collages. I've mentioned it before on the radio, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to bring it in.
It
to
is
show
beautiful.
You how pretty it is. And my other, like, can't-miss book of the year was Yotam Ottolenghi's Jerusalem, which is filled with salads and wonderful things that involve no meat at all.
I believe I was hosting the day that you recommended that book. Carol says she's been impressed with recipes from the Bonne Femme cookbook, Simple Splendid Food That French Women Cook All Day by Winnie Maranville. Basic recipes. Do you know that cookbook?
I don't know that cookbook.
Okay.
I'm so glad to hear about it.
Last night we had chicken breasts with curry sauce on a bed of spinach. We all loved it, including my teens. So that's good to know.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, well, we're going to go back because seriously, Sarah came in here with this giant bag of books. That's not often the case, but it's so exciting. You have a tinkerer's recommendation. So that was for the meat. Bruce Adell's book was for the butchering, hearty, kind of guys and gals among us. But tinkering folks are more like bakery folks. They're folks who like...
Yeah, the people who want the next challenge, they want to be, food artisans, people who might be interested in jam making, or who might be interested again in curing things. Well, this book is the book, sort of magnum opus of Sandor Elix Katz. He's actually a guy I met. I wrote about him for Sever a couple years ago, and he is like the Pied Piper of fermentation in this country.
Okay. And
the man who's gotten people making sauerkrauts and pickles and not just that, not just vegetables, but also yogurts and kefir and all sorts of stuff. And this book has everything. It has how to make, you know, if you want to make your own miso, you know, and which is a slightly more complicated process because you need to grow mold first and then you mix this rice mold in with your beans. But it's fascinating, and it's fascinating to read the stories. Even, you know, once again, there's a lot to read that you might not make.
So this would go well for somebody who already bought the complete modernist cuisine book, there's the home version of the modernist cuisine, which is still kind of a hefty price tag and a hefty read, but probably will be a classic.
Yes, although having seen both the modernist cuisine kitchen and Sandor Elix Katz's kitchen,
is this easier?
This is much funkier, much earthier. I mean, he had been living on a commune for 17 or 19.
So there was mold growing in the walls.
Yeah, it's an earthy place. he's no longer there. He moved out of the commune, but still lives around the corner. So anyway, it's fascinating, and it really documents, you know, how human culture has. I mean, it's goofy sounding, but how human culture has grown up with these microflora. Whether it's in cheese or beer or wine or mead.
So this really, it's not just for the tinker, but for somebody who maybe has a scientific bent.
Yeah, or just, you know, just sort of an interest in food history, too. I mean, and how cultures evolve and foods that evolve with cultures. But it's fun, too. I mean, it's really fun to make your own yogurt. You don't have to go deep. You can just make yogurt or buttermilk or something like that.
What do you need to make yogurt?
Yogurt, you need...
I eat a lot of yogurt.
You need some good milk, and you need some yogurt. with live cultures.
Yogurt that I liked, or does it not
matter?
Yeah,
you choose the culture, because if you like a more sour yogurt, you want to use a more sour culture. If you use a sweeter culture, then you know, whatever you prefer. Or you can get powdered cultures as well. But basically, I mean, you heat it and you keep it at a certain temperature. But basically, you add the old yogurt to the new milk, and it makes yogurt.
So you don't need that little, I remember years ago.
A little yogurt maker?
Yeah.
No, you want to insulate it. So you could use, there's different ways of insulating it. You could use one of those. You could also use a cooler and fill it with warm water.
Wow.
And top it with that, and that will work.
I'm sensing like these kind of fermentation things borderline on something that could kill you if you didn't do it right.
Well, he does a lot to counteract fears
of death, of death by food.
Fermentation, in the sense that fermentation is a way to preserve food. And he addresses food safety issues. But there's also an unruly, you know, I think we don't think about all the bacteria we eat every day.
Okay, so I should just sort of take a deep breath and just say everything's dirty or something like that.
No, or something step by step. Start with yogurt, and then if you decide you want to make miso.
Well, looking at this Art of Fermentation book is reminding me of a bread book that a friend of mine gave me, which I like to read through, but it's possibly the most complicated bread book I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because there's pages of, I mean, each recipe, it's not like mix yeast with water and
right.
sugar. It's more like here's how it works. Because that's fermented. I mean, isn't it?
It is. It's a fermented product. It's no longer a live culture because you've killed the the yeast in cooking, but you wouldn't have bubbles in your bread if you didn't have yeast producing carbon dioxide.
It's dead. Well, what about when you keep sourdough?
You're keeping in
before
cooking,
you bake.
Cooking, yeah, when you bake it, that's when you kill the yeast.
You can see I'm not a bread baker. These are things that elude me. So maybe you have some book that, you know, off the top of your head that I should look at that's going to simplify baking bread for
any
me.
Any number of kneading free bread cookbooks
right.
that have come out in the past few years. There's one by Jim Leahy. I'm not remembering the name of it. Another one called Needlessly Simple. They'll both make bread baking much easier.
I actually have made Jim Leahy's pizza dough because that is all over online. You can you can find it in Bon Appetit for 72 people, and you can find the version for 4 people, which is pretty easy. It's flour and water overnight.
Yeah.
If I were looking for sort of basic cookbook, I'm thinking of cookbooks that I go, you know, obviously the Joy of Cooking was the basic cookbook.
Right.
New York Times, what do you recommend?
That's a really great question. I actually did an article several years ago where I made my husband cook for me because he doesn't cook at all. And
mine either.
And I had him try different basic cookbooks. And our conclusion at the time was that Bittman's How to Cook Everything is really a great standard.
But
not for baking. No, more for just everyday cooking. Mm-hmm. And he's definitely got a particular kind of grumpy voice that I kind of enjoy, but I put some people off. My husband, being an engineer at heart, loves the Cook's Illustrated Best Recipe Compendium, and they have a basic one, and then they break it out into several categories. It's a really good one. I find them a little less exciting because they're not playful, and I like a little playfulness.
Oh no, it's not playful.
No.
Cooking. It is. It is.
But
it's formulaic.
But for a beginner cook, you're not going to go wrong with those recipes. And then finally, I'd also recommend Ina Garten's new book is totally super heavy duty tested recipes, and she, you know, I like her recipes. She's omnipresent, but I think she does a good job.
Wow. Well, if you haven't picked out one cookbook among these for the people on your list, we've got them on our website. You can think about them a little more or go to the cookbook section at a bookstore and just peruse.
Paw through them.
Yeah. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, The New York Times, and other publications, and you can find her online at sarahdickerman.com. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Marcy.
Andy Hurst is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi. Alexandra Garrettin and Danielle Anthony Goodwin are the interns. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scherr tomorrow. Take a look at the week's news with our panel of journalists here on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
Good morning, it's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from the EnviroStars Business Certification Program, recognizing EnviroStars Animal Hospital of Factoria for its commitment to environmentally sustainable business practices. A directory of businesses meeting certification standards is available at envirostars.org.
There's nothing funny about Chris Rock's work ethic.
I'm really trying to act here.
And legendary musician Herb Alpert just tries to sound like himself.
And that's, I think, what everybody should be going for.
The backstory of two artists at work. I'm Alec Baldwin. Each week on Here's the Thing from WNYC and PRX, I talk with artists, policymakers, and performers. It's where I find out why people do what they do.
And that comes your way tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. This is...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.